start by acknowledging the territories upon which we're all gathered here today in honor of the struggle of the indigenous peoples of this land who've been fighting on occupied territories for centuries before all of us have gathered here. As Nazila mentioned, speaking in particular just on two things. One is sort of broadly around international or struggles against colonialism internationally and sort of the construct of colonialism historically, and specifically talking about decolonization from the perspective and struggles of racialized communities, immigrants and refugees who have also been struggling under Canadian colonial laws for their self-determination, and the sort of links and solidarity that's been growing. In particular, I want to talk about some of the work that I've been doing with Arnie and others, but also growing here in Montreal and many other cities and around Turtle Island and North America around these issues and the importance of that decolonization movement among many different communities. In terms of talking about colonialism, one of the things that's been going around for a long time is that when we talk about colonialism, it's the predecessor to globalization, and understanding globalization means understanding colonialism, and also a lot of talk about, well, we can't talk about any such thing as post-colonialism or neo-colonialism because they're all continuations of ongoing colonialism. So using such new labels and sort of new ways to redesign colonialism doesn't do it any service because it is essentially all the same. I think although that's essentially true, colonialism is ongoing, it is important to talk about the different ways in which it does operate in the current context, because without understanding those nuances of how colonialism might have changed, we're not as effective in being able to resist in our movements. And one of the ways is in particular, I think, is sort of the degree of arrogance or overtness of colonialism that we've seen in the past 100 years. So in the 1800s and early 1900s, when we talked about colonialism, sort of to use Rudyard Kipling's very famous phrase, colonialism was often couched as the white man's burden and this civilizational project, which undoubtedly hasn't changed now, but it was very overt in being about civilization and bringing civilization to indigenous people, bringing civilization to backwards people around the third world, and it was very overt in that form. But today, due to a lot of resistance to that, and certainly not just recently, but at least in the past few decades, due to resistance to this form of very overt, direct rule, you see more and more, a far more insidious form of colonialism, which is, you know, can be termed indirect rule. And it's particularly insidious because it basically implies that colonialism under your own is somehow more beneficial to the people. So we see that through the band council system, which is essentially a form of indirect rule. We see it through all the various puppet regimes that the US and Canada have supported in Haiti and Iraq and Iran and Afghanistan and all around the world. And it is far more insidious because in that way it basically entrenches a new form of colonialism and repackages it in some way by saying it's traditional or cultural. And in that way, it makes it far more harder for people to be able to resist it, because now it's being repackaged as something that is indigenous to the people, that these forms of governance are somehow indigenous to the people. And obviously, one of the greatest impacts is faced around colonial gender oppression, because then any talk about colonial forms of gender oppression become completely silenced, because these forms of gender oppression and patriarchy are also seen as indigenous to a culture, or seen as indigenous to indigenous cultures here and also third world cultures. And that leads very much so to this new face of colonialism and occupation, which is very directly tied to the politics of liberating women and children. And Joanne's talked a little bit about that. So by being able to say that all of these things, that gender oppression and patriarchy and these sort of very authoritarian forms of governance are indigenous to cultures, it allows for now this new face, certainly the same project of bringing civilization around the third world and to indigenous people. It's able to now take this far more somewhat humanitarian, what appears to be humanitarian, face to colonialism under the guise of, well, we're bringing democracy and we're all very familiar with that. We're bringing democracy, we're bringing human rights, and we're bringing, we're liberating the women and children around the third world. So this sort of repackaging of indirect rule is directly linked to being able to, for this new phase of colonization by sanctifying this culture. And this becomes very important, as Joanne has talked about it. There's much, obviously, to be learned from what's happened to Indigenous peoples here, and to honor that, because when we know what is liberating women and children means, it means residential schools, it means forced sterilization, it means further gender oppression in countries that people are facing colonization. And this occupation, whether it's, you know, centuries old or new, one of the defining features of occupation and colonialism is basically its arbitrariness, in that it's completely arbitrary in a state being able to determine a people's territorial and political sovereignty, and that's essentially Canada. The Crown has asserted sovereignty over lands that were previously occupied by Indigenous people. That is occupation around the third world, where occupation becomes the legitimacy of foreign powers being able to assert sovereignty over people who already have territorial control and are able to self-determine their futures. BC in particular, I'm sure Arnie will touch on this, British Columbia is unceded territory. There are no treaties that have been signed other than three in British Columbia. It is unsurrendered territory, and yet the British government has somehow asserted sovereignty over BC, and people are supposed to believe this. So there's a quote by John Burroughs, and he's written that the very essence of occupation is to have one's status arbitrarily redefined by the colonizing state without an adequate explanation of its reasons for doing so. And this sort of circular approach basically assumes what it attempts to prove. You're attempting to prove how sovereignty, but in doing so, you basically assume that Indigenous people never had sovereignty or that the Crown has always had sovereignty. And this arbitrariness has, again, just sort of shifted in different ways, and we see it reproduced all around the third world with all the current occupations that that are ongoing. And Joanne has also touched on this, but the maintenance of the colonial system obviously depends very much on a system of racism, again, whether in the third world or the so-called fourth world, and that depends on basically the manipulation of certain facts by the colonizer to be able to legitimize the fact that the colonized people ought to be colonized. And this very much depends on being able to say that people are not human, that people are backward, that people have no culture, that they need to be civilized. One of the most insidious aspects of that is that although then the colonizer is able to sort of ascribe these objective values to people by saying that, you know, for example, Indigenous people are welfare bums, or South Asians are inherently violent, or whatever it might be, Chinese Canadians are grabbing land in Richmond. So although they've sort of ascribed these objective realities to people, whenever people fighting against racism attempt to talk about this racism, attempt to talk about this negative stereotyping, it just becomes as if though it's a subjective reality, right? Joanne talked about that. It's as if though people are just whining. They've sort of invented this racism as if though it doesn't exist, even though the very process of ascribing these qualities to people was done by the colonizers. And when people attempt to fight back against it, then it's just said, oh, well, you're just whining. And people fight back and say, no, we're not just whining. In fact, we refuse to continue to be re-victimized in this way. We refuse to continue to be ascribed in a certain way when we are in fact not, we are not this way. And one of, I guess, the most salient examples is obviously in the post-9/11 climate, where obviously essentially everyone who happens to be Arab, South Asian, or Muslim is suddenly being deemed a terrorist or a potential threat to our security. And that racial profiling is quite evident, and that racial profiling is a double standard by which our communities are being held accountable for the actions of one, two, however many people they were, for the acts of 9/11. We are now all collectively being held accountable for the acts of certain individuals in our community. And sort of by analogy, when the Oklahoma City bombings happened, there was no profiling of all white men aged 18 to 45 because they were not being held responsible for the acts of one person. That's racial profiling. We are all being held collectively accountable for the acts of some people in our community, because we are all, the only characteristic we can all share is that we're all terrorists, right? We are all the same. We are all one-dimensional. We all act in the same way. And obviously, the other forms of racial profiling and that insidious racism is evident constantly, and you see it in the media. When you have, for example, any story about corruption in band councils, it's as if though, well, you know, none of those natives know how to control their money. They're all the same. Or there's various stories. I currently live in Vancouver. There's always stories about South Asian gang violence. And that is, it's always described as being somewhat inherent to South Asian people, that we're somehow more prone to being criminals. And obviously, you know, any stories of white folks who are engaged in gang violence, it's never an ethnic issue. So that's sort of some of that racism that the colonial system depends on. And in talking about colonization and racism, sort of as the background, to being able to talk about then some of the shared histories of migration and displacement that racialized communities here in Canada face, being able to talk about, although certainly racialized communities, immigrant refugee communities, and Indigenous communities face quite distinct histories, that history of colonization and continuing colonization and dealing with racism, both at home and both after migrating, are very, very real, and those are commonalities that our communities face. One sort of interesting fact is that until I think 1954, what is currently the Department of Indian Affairs used to be called the Department of Immigration and Colonization, until 1954. And the DIA didn't exist. It basically existed under the Department of Immigration and Colonization, which registered all of the sort of Hudson Bay companies and all its successors, as well as was tasked with starting to solidify the reserve system. So that's sort of a very distinct example of that.